See? Don, could you take roll?
Representative Burkhardt.
Here.
Representative Larson.
Here.
Representative Schwartz.
Here.
Representative Summers.
Here.
Representative Walters.
Here.
Representative Wilson. Senator Dockstader. Senator Hass, Senator Driscoll.
Excuse.
Senator Hastert.
Here.
Senator Landon.
Here.
Co-Chairman Burns.
Here.
Chairman Nicholas.
Here.
Mr. Chairman, you have quorum.
Thank you. So, first up, we've got a couple things we'd like to address with DFS and the computer system. So, please, front and center. And if you got any money in your pockets, please put it in a jar in front of you. Welcome, Director. Quorn.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Forsley. I'm the Director of Department of Family Services.
So, we called back because we wanted a more detailed explanation of the computer system, the 9 million request basically for DFS, timing of it, the need, alternatives if you don't get it, just a more of a background information. It was we just don't we don't have 9 million kind of flipping around someplace where we can grab it and assign it, so help us out a little.
Mr. Chairman, regards to the issue that you're talking about, this is the system that deals with eligibility of applicants to various programs within the Department of Family Services. When I was before you in December, we were talking about a different system, and I mentioned to you that the eligibility system is also antiquated. And at that time, you all had asked for some additional information on that and to bring it forward to you in our follow-up information. So we put that together relatively quickly and provided to you in the document that we provided or sent to you with all the questions. And it's in attachment A. Is the background. And so just a quick overview is the Department of Health and Department of Family Services in the past have, make sure that you, what I'm talking about is this document here that is dated January 10th. And it's response to questions from the Joint Appropriation Budget Hearing is the title to it.
Mr. Chairman, this was handout 162, and it's not from this morning. It was previously provided. It should be in your 048 folder in your filing cabinet. 049, excuse me.
And, excuse me, and it's attachment A to that document. So going back in history, eligibility for low-income individuals wanting assistance from the state for either services through Department of Family Services or services through Department of Health, particularly Medicaid, people would make applications to through the DFS office, and it was a very old, antiquated system, and it required multiple handlings by individuals. It was prone to errors. And so we moved to, we being the Department of Health, moved to putting a new eligibility system in place. And the federal government paid 90% of the cost of that new system, as well then the state had to come up with 10%. We, as the Department of Health, implemented that system. But it was designed in such a way that you could not only have eligibility for Department of Health Medicaid participants, but you also could put different components or modules into it for other program eligibility. And so the concept from the beginning was Department of Health would go first, get the eligibility for Medicaid in place and up running, because we were required by the ACA to have it in place by January 1st of 2014. So we got it in place, the Department of Health. And the idea was always that DFS would come in afterwards and put their module onto it, eligibility, for its programs. The Department of Family Services proceeded down that road to start working on it, and then they backed off. And I'm not sure why. I think primarily it was due to budgetary concerns at that point in time, but they backed away from it. So they're still in an old eligibility system that was built sometime in the early 90s, and it's it needs to be updated.
So with regards to when did they back away, did they ever address any funds towards it? Did anything happen?
They did some, Mr. Chairman, they did some preliminary planning, and then they backed away in, I think, 2015, if I'm not mistaken. So when we were discussing this in December, you asked us to bring in some information if we tried to move forward with it now. And so we, as I told you, we worked on it in December for a few weeks before we had to get this back to you the first week or so in January. We have done our best to estimate the cost of it and what the federal participation is or might be and what the state costs would be. And we gave you a breakdown of that, of the different components. And our best guess at this point in time, and I want you to understand, it was put together quickly. But our best guess right now is the state general fund contribution to the system would be approximately $9.3 million for the work, plus then $250,000 annually during the project to cover project manager staffing needs and basically the administration of, because I got to have somebody, some people working on it like we did in health. The overall estimated cost is $35.5 million, of which then we estimate the state general fund for the system build is $9.3 million. And one of the wild cards in this is federal funds from CMS at 90-10 are scheduled to end at the end of this calendar year. And we don't know at this point in time whether they will extend that 90-10 match or not. This has run out before, and they have extended it. And now this is a new administration. Whether they're going to extend it, I don't know. But in other discussions and watching CMS under the current administration, basically they're working on the bill to replace the ACA this last summer. They had also put into those bills enhanced match for technology. So I think they're inclined to support it and want to continue to it, but there's no guarantee today on that. So we would have to try to get as much done as we could in calendar year 18.
So, and, Director, explain why you couldn't, if you started tomorrow, explain what the process is that you can't capture all of the 90% between now and December 31st.
It's a matter of the process that you have to go through, that steps you have to go through to meet federal guidelines, and there's you got to do advanced planning document, submit it to CMS. They have to review it, approve it. Then it goes back. We have to go through the selection of vendors. then we have to then, you know, the RFP process, then we have to award the contract, and then they have to start to put it into place. So
you can't do that between now and December?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it would be a challenge, but I think if we could get a green light as quickly as possible, I think it's worth a try. And if we could get down the road, hopefully CMS would continue to allow that enhanced match for us.
What's required to get a green? I mean, what's the initial funding you need between now and tomorrow?
What the key would be is some type. We have to demonstrate to CMS that there is state funds available to draw off of. And so we would need some type of action or something to demonstrate that, that the department's just not going rogue and going through a process and there's no support from the legislature or basically money to back up our claims. So we need some type of action by the legislature. Generally, in an appropriation is sufficient. We don't need a bill. We just need some type of appropriation. So an appropriation that would become immediate would be what would be needed.
For example, if we did an immediate appropriation of $2 million and then guaranteed the remaining balance so that we don't have to, because if we don't have the dollars available now, is that something that would work?
Mr. Chairman, if you want us to get it done by the end of the year, we would need the whole $9 million.
Well, I understand that. I mean, the guarantee would, it's guaranteed, so if you need it, you get it. The question is dollars in hand versus dollars not in hand.
Whatever that we can demonstrate and show, I think CMS would accept it.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Director Forsen. As I looked at your, was reviewing that table one this morning, the question that came to my mind was it looks like that this system is, it's almost a component. And so my question was, is could you do the power component to it at a different time than perhaps then add in the SNAP component and then add in the 4E and so on, you know, depending on requirements, or does that have to all be constructed at the same time to
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, you are correct. These are components that we could do it separate from one another. The downside of that is these systems are on an old mainframe system now. So if you're going to, you know, let's just say do the a portion of them, and that would mean we would have to, in effect, be running two systems. One is the new one and then keeping the old mainframe system up until such time as we have the money to do the rest of the components. So you'd be running two separate systems, which with the associated cost of operations. So that would be the downside of it. But in terms of what you're saying, is it possible? Yes, it is.
Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So is it possible to just continue? And I know you talked about the need for this, but what happens if we don't fund it? What do you do with the old system? Is the old system maintainable at all? Does it die in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years? The federal or the federal system doesn't overlay with it anymore and it's unusable. What are the consequences of us not doing anything?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, the consequences, we just continue to operate an old system and limp along as long as the system continues to work. Again, it's in the world of technology, you know, it's something built in the early 1990s. It's antiquated and it doesn't provide us access to information as You know, we get asked anymore for a lot of information from this group, from other committees, and the idea is, the expectation is, we're able to produce that information relatively quickly. When you're dealing with antiquated systems, it's not easily accessible, and consequently, we struggle to answer questions. In terms of the system processing applicants, it'll continue to limp along, and we can make it work going forward, but it's subject to errors, and it's just not efficient. And one of the things that you all had an efficiency study commissioned this last year, you had a third party come in, take a look at it, and they have talked quite a bit in their report, as you know, about technology and investment in technology to get efficiency. And this is an example, from in my mind, is, you know, you make an investment and you gain efficiencies. Without it, you just don't gain the efficiencies. But I don't want to sound an alarm. The thing is ready to collapse tomorrow, and we won't be able to process people anymore. That's not the case.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, so, and they always, the problem with the efficiency studies and the technology, and I've seen this over and over, is you never realize efficiency in personnel. So if we do this, are you going to say that you don't need two people, three people, four people? So are we going to effectuate enough efficiencies to reduce other budgetary items to help compensate for this $9 million?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, putting in new technology, in my experience over many years of doing it, does generally not generate significant cost savings related to personnel. So I will not sit here and tell you if we do this, we can eliminate two or three positions. I won't do it. The efficiency would be coming from what I mentioned in the answers is, one, hopefully we're going to gain efficiency through processing of applications and accuracy in applications, which is a bigger issue in my mind than a personnel issue. It's the accuracy, and that's what we saw in Medicaid, is our increased efficiency or accuracy in processing the applications for applicants, because it's a rule-based system. You kick it through, and it's like, yes, you do qualify or you don't. It's automatic, as opposed to a human potentially making that determination and making an error. So that's where I see the efficiency. The second part of it is what I talked about, being able to provide information, so to inform you all on information to inform your decision making, and not only you all as policymakers, but also in the department and where we're trying to decide whether we're doing a good job or not, or need information, be able to access it quickly, as opposed to somebody in many cases having to go through a spreadsheet and build stuff. It takes forever.
Senator Duxer.
Thank you, Director. I see what you're looking at. We got a significant expense here. I sense you're saying we're not at the cliff yet on this, but we will be in the next year or two. Can we buy any time at all, or are we about where we're at?
Mr. Chairman, again, I did not bring this in as an exception request. This came about as a discussion we had in December, and so we can continue to limp along. I'm not saying this has to be done today. One of the advantages of today is you got to enhanced federal match for the system, or at least a portion of the system, and I don't know, it's supposed to go away at the year end. It might not, I don't know. So if we hold off a couple years and then go ahead and do it, from an operation point of view, we can continue to do that, but it might cost us more at that point. It might not. I can't answer that definitively today.
Thank you. Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think that's the recollection that I have is what brought my ears forward when I heard this was that that 90-10 funding run out at runs out at the end of 2018, and the questions were asked by this committee on why in the world did we let that happen if we could get 90% reimbursement. And so we asked the department to come back in and help us understand and try and determine if we could still make this work and leverage state general funds to the 90-10 match. And so as we look at this, Director, and I realize that you didn't bring this on as an exception request, but as we consider this, is there a possibility, as Chairman Nicholas pointed out, that if we had some extra funds that we could, again, for example, go to the DFS client web portal that we know we could get 90% reimbursement and do that program, get that reimbursement, perhaps the power, you know, some of that we can get the higher reimbursement rate and put this together over the next period of time. I understand that you have two systems still working, but is that, if you had a preference, would you rather do it all at once, or is it feasible to say that we can?
I'm Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson. Answer the second part of that is it feasible? Yes. Is it desirable? No. And again, the part of the risk here is in ETS, and ETS having the staff to maintain the current system, and because it's old system, and it's just like with our Medicaid MMIS, which we're replacing now, is that thing is built in COBOL. And it's fine as long as you have people who are still trained and know how to deal with COBOL language. But as people retire, people leave, you don't have that expertise anymore. That's where the risks come in. So you have an old system built on old languages, and people get ready to retire, and can you replace them? So is it immediate? No, but it's a risk. So ideally, I'd prefer to do it all at once, but can you just pick out a piece? Absolutely.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, going back to the discussion of the efficiencies and talking about the increased accuracy, do you have any thoughts as far as whether having both the Medicaid system and the DFS programs on the newer systems, would you know, I'm looking at the assistance part of DFS budget is something like $200 million, a little bit higher. You know, if there would, say, be a 10%, 5% reduction in, and I won't identify it all as fraud. I mean, some is just erroneous claims, maybe. Do you have any feeling for what the reduction in that might be with the new system?
Mr. Chairman, if you just, I want to get a number here. Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, to answer your question in terms of DFS, I can't tell you. But what I can do is relate the information to us or to you that we experienced when we went to the new Medicaid eligibility system and did our cleanup. And at that point in time, remember the old system, again, it was done through DFS, and it was done through this old eligibility system. We went through the new system, ran them all the people through it, and we dropped a little over 3,000 people off of the rolls who were on the rolls that should not have been on the rolls any longer. There's a variety of reasons for it, but at the end of the day, there were over 3,000 that we dropped off. Since that time, our enrollment in overall has continued to drop because, and part of it is we've got a darn good eligibility system in place that is rules-based, it's electronic, and we run it through it, and it just takes out that human error aspect that existed before. Now, do we have the same issues in DFS? I can't tell you today. I would suspect we have some same issues, but until we put it into place and work through it, I'm not going to sit here and say we could drop a number of people off because who are on it, who shouldn't be. I don't know that. But I can just tell you what the experience was in health and the Medicaid program.
Go ahead.
So, Director, that 3,000, that's approximately, what, maybe 4% of the total enrollment or so? We have 85,000, am I remembering correctly?
Mr. Medicaid? Chairman, Representative Wilson, a little over 70.
Please.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So, and maybe I misunderstood this. So there's the upfront cost of the hardware, software, whatever it is. And then there's an ongoing cost. And did you say that that was $250,000 a year?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, no. What I said is you have the cost of the hardware and software, in effect. But you need somebody to oversee the project. So you need a project lead and so we have to contract with individuals who have the expertise to be able to work with the vendors to basically be the project lead. So what we do in health is we have a project manager that we contract. It used to be directly through ETS. ETS can't handle that anymore, so we have to contract out. So it's a temporary, in effect, AWAC type assistance to help us through the whole acquisition and implementation phase. Then you back away, but because I don't have anybody who's just sitting around and who can take on a major IT project within the department. I mean, through the ETS consolidation, all IT expertise was stripped out of the agencies. So then as ETS has had to downsize their expertise, they can't do that project management. So we have to contract out now to have somebody help us through a major IT project. So that's where that's a short-term cost associated with the project that goes away at the end of the project. But if not, I can say, Corin, you're in charge of this IT project, and she's looking for the on and off button type, and we need somebody with that type of project management in IT expertise to help. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a failed project like other state projects in years past where the state invested in a new system and it failed because of during the implementation phase.
So just to follow up on that, so Mr. Chairman, so if we've – so the $9.317 million is just – it doesn't include that manager, that in-house manager piece. And then in addition, there'd be more – are you guys able to cover that out of your existing budget? So if we funded the hardware, software, you guys would find a way to do the rest of it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, I don't know what you're going to do to our budget. And so I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, yeah, no problem, or there is no way.
So, Director, you've got data conversion at 3 million. Is that part of that component, or is that?
No. Mr. Chairman, if you take a look at that first paragraph right under that table.
Yeah, I see. Yeah. So then my question is, there's only one component of this that you have marked at 90% cost reimbursement. The rest are at separate percentages. What do we know about the time frames for those other funding sources? Are they also December 18 issues, or are they?
Mr. Chairman, we'll double check. Mr. Chairman, everything in the column is December 18 at this point in time.
And then why is only that one component, the DFSN's client web portal, 90%, and not the DFS work web portal? I mean, I could explain that.
Mr. Chairman, different federal agencies. The 90-10 is through CMS, and that's where we, Department of Health works with. And that's the component that CMS would pay at 90%. The other is a different federal agency, and that's what their enhanced match is at this point.
Is there different likelihoods in terms of the funding entities on which may more likely be extended versus others, just from past experience or knowing who's running what show? And
Mr. Chairman, it's a new ball game. We can't. We've reached out to federal agencies, and at this point in time, we have not gotten the word back. And I don't think we're going to get it, because I don't think they will put their necks out and say, "Oh yeah, it's no problem. Go ahead with it." And then it doesn't, and then we're upset with them.
So you have you have a 3-year implementation program here. If we fund the 90% and the 80% components to it, then you only need $3.5 million at this point. And then you can come back for the remainder in a supplemental budget because you're just initiating the program. Is that feasible?
Mr. Chairman, as I mentioned before, that is a possibility. Now, the 3 years is what is a normal process to go through. And that's why it's here. It's like just if it were just no deadlines and such, we'd say we want 3 years to go work this thing through. But you mentioned in December, what's it going to take to get this thing done? Or maybe it was January, whatever it is, quickly. And can you do it? We said we could try. Yeah, no guarantee, but we can try. So can we expedite it? Yeah, we can try, but if it's just a normal project, no time limit, we would ask for 3 years. In terms of doing one or two components in there, yeah, we can do it, just with the downside of you're talking two different systems.
So in terms of the particular systems that you have budgeted here, are you locked into the hardware component of it to match what is currently in what you put in health, or are you going out to bid for kind of a different systems? And how did you come up with these particular dollars,
Mr. Chairman? The idea was all along as we selected the. In very simplistic terms, is a base, and then you put the different components in it. So that is in place in health now, and we have the base with the Medicaid component in there. So what we'd be doing is to acquiring new bases or new components to or modules to put in for the DFS. So we're not going to go out and ask for a brand new system. We're going to ask for components to put into our base system where we've already made the investment, and the vision is just going to continue on through.
So is this, if you go RFP, how many providers are available to do it? Does it make sense to do RFP versus single source, particularly in timing to get your maximum dollars, or how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that I told you at our last meeting is one way to save time is to sole source some of this work. But, I mean, I want to make sure everyone understood that we'd be sole sourcing, and some people might not be happy with it, but it would make sense.
How firm are you on these figures?
Mr. Chairman, they were put together between when we met with you in mid-December and when this was issued to you in the first of January. We're as comfortable as we could in that short period of time. I'm not going to sit here and say this is absolutely hard, fast number that is not going to change, because it was an estimate put together quickly per your request.
Further questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, looking at the main programs that are affected by this, and so I'm going to the department's assistance and service budgets, and I appreciate that you're not setting exact percentage numbers of reductions of you know, mistakenly enrolled people. I mean, I'm just making sure that I'm kind of working with the right material. So I'm on page 31 of the DFS budget. And so we have the SNAP program with a $1.6 million biennial cost, the child care with 25.8, the TANF, which is the power, at 21.7, and then I assume local services, which is, I'm not quite sure, maybe the staffing for those, at $113 million. Am I looking at, as far as if I'm mentally trying to say, okay, how much money do we spend on these programs and to be able to kind of match that up, you know, I mean, if we were to have, say, a 5% reduction in enrollment or something, you know, you can see I'm trying to do sort of a cost-benefit analysis. Are those the right four programs, and have I left anything out as far as because it's, I assume that the worker and the client portals are kind of a requirement to operate the whole thing with regardless of which programs they're coming into.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, I would take out the local services. That's staff, you know, within the field offices. So that would not apply.
I think the real question is, on your data conversion, is that required once you get the things up and running? So you've got that. If we do one, you're going to need the data conversion. So that's the big cost variable. If we do two things, one has to be the data conversion. Is that fair?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Doesn't matter.
Further questions? Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Forslund, thank you for all the information you've shared this morning again to try to help us get arms around this. The piece that is bothering me is we're considering a consolidation, which is a fairly major undertaking. We face a change in leadership at the state level, which may result in a change at the administrative level for the Department of Health, Department of Family Services, whether we consolidate or not. How concerned are you about all of that taking place if we were to put this on the department in an expedited fashion? Is it realistic for all of that to take place at once and for us to expedite something like this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Landon, a couple different things in regards to your question. And consolidation or no consolidation, I think before last time we were here, you wanted to know if this should be held off due to consolidation, or, you know, whether it's going to be consolidated or not. And I said before, and I'll say it again, is whether it's consolidated or not consolidated, this is a project that should go forward for the need to replace that eligibility system, bring it up to modern standards, and whether it's consolidated or not, it needs to be done. Timing is the next part of that, is new leadership potentially coming first of the year. The need for a new system is there, and hopefully any new director would recognize the need for that and would want to continue on. the people working on the project manager and the staff working on it would not be at the senior management level. It'd be lower. And so I don't think that would be impacted at all by a change in a leadership, either consolidated or not consolidated. That's irrelevant. I don't think that should have any impact unless a new director comes in and says, I hate technology and I want to take everything back to paper. Then, that would be a waste at that point. But short of that, I don't think so. I think the question is to me, is it's a heavy lift in 11 months or less, whether it's a change in leadership or not change of leadership. And that's why we're going to – another reason why we need this outside help, this project manager and staff to assist in that, just like we are on our MMIS and like what we did on our eligibility system for health. And so without that support, that IT support, then I'd say – don't put any money into it, and let's not do it for now. Because if the commitment's not there to get the resources there, it's an impossible lift, and must back away from it for the time being.
Further questions?
Okay, seeing none, appreciate it. We will do what we can. Next, we had some questions for the Department of Education. So a lot of these questions centered around the St. Stephen's School, and I just want to, if it's more of a, just a background information and data inquiry, it's the, I think we all recognize that the St. Stephen's School provides a real service to the reservation. It actually saves overall state dollars because of the additional components of cost sharing that we have with our federal counterparts that help fund that. On the other hand, we just want to make sure and understand how the process is conducted, the oversight that's performed by the Wyoming Department of Education, and the cooperativeness of the how things have been proceeding. So if you can please introduce yourselves and give us a rough background of, and then once that, we'll start jumping into our questions, okay? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Trent Carroll, WDE Finance Director, and with me today is Jed Ciccarelli, our School Foundation Team Supervisor. The superintendent and our chief officers had prior commitments today, but they send their regards. And we are here to talk about St. Stephen's. And, Mr. Chairman, in response to the questions that came up yesterday, we prepared a memo that you should have as a handout. And we also sent over the most recent copy of the St. Stephen's annual expenditure report. And so we will be referencing both of those documents as we proceed this morning. To start off, I wanted to provide a few overall comments about the program. I know that yesterday there were several questions about funding process and accountability. And I guess I would just preface our statements today with a reminder that neither Jed nor I are experts on the accountability side. But I can tell you that in reviewing everything, there are accountability requirements that currently exist at both the federal and state level. We currently use our contract with St. Stephen's to ensure that the existing statutory requirements are met and that we receive the information that we need to calculate the funding and to ensure the other requirements under statute. Prior to 2015, we would establish a contract with the Joint Business Council of the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho Tribes. After that Joint Business Council was dissolved in 2014, we started a process where we contract with each tribe every year, alternating the tribe under contract. The requirements are the same for both tribes. Specifically, we require the following deliverables. We require them to provide a summary report of their revenue. We require their ADM data, a copy of their school year budget itemized by budget category, their enrollment and staffing data, a report summarizing their state expenditures related to school improvement plan goals, and that's included in this report that we've provided, and their statewide assessment scores by grade.
So with regards to the ADM and enrollment data, when you see a 25% fluctuation from year to year on the number of students reported, to me that kind of raises a red flag. And you want to know, well, number one, are you counting students twice from the various schools on the reservation? Because they are in very close proximity, and that suggests there's a lot of kids moving back and forth. And so what one of the concerns we have is, are we paying twice for those kids, and how often do you update the data? And if you see large variances in enrollment, then do you go back and go to Arapaho, or you go to the other schools and say, or you find out where the kids came from, so that we're not duplicating cost payments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jed Ciccarelli, the School Foundation Supervisor. I think most of those questions are addressed in the memo that we provided to the committee. And with your permission, I'd be happy to step through those.
Sure. Just give us a quick synopsis of it.
Sure. Regarding the possibility of counting students twice, St. Stephen's does use the same unique identifiers in accordance with our state registration system. So the same IDs that are used to track students within the public school districts are the same IDs that are used for St. Stephen's. And as part of the contract requirements, we do require enrollment reports to be submitted by St. Stephen's.
How often?
Those are collected, Mr. Chairman, three times a year, in the fall, in the spring, at the end of the year. And as part of that data collection process, our data team does a validation and reviews records for accuracy. They do look for areas where there's overlapping enrollments with other districts, and so there is a validation process, at least with regards to the enrollment. The membership is what we determine the calculations based off of, is rather than enrollment, which is a snapshot in time of the students that are actively enrolled in a district. The membership is more of a measure of a full-time equivalency. It takes into account the time that the students either enrolled and receiving or actively receiving or prospectively receiving instructional services, whether they're in attendance or absent on that day. And that's what we use to determine the funding at the end of the year. that is updated for the calculations after the completion of the fiscal year. St. Stephen's will provide us with a updated membership count. For the budget request, we use the most recent data we had available, which was 16-17. When we generate payment or actually issue the contract, we'll revise those figures. We'll update the revenue that St. Stephen's receives that's commensurate with the way the resources are allocated through the funding model. We'll provide updates for both the three Fremont proxy districts for the calculations as well as St. Stephen's. So that is updated at the end of the year and before the contracts are issued. With regards to the mobility that you mentioned between St. Stephen's and the Fremont school districts, in the memo, I'll draw your attention to the first attachment. It says mobility between Fremont Public School Districts and St. Stephen's Indian School. And this is an analysis that our senior statistician, Vince Meyer, put together that provides some data points with regards to that inward and outward mobility for St. Stephen's. Page 5.
Go ahead.
So, Mr. Chairman, the department began collecting the enrollment data in October 2014. So what you see here are 3 years' worth of an analysis that takes into account those movements between schools and school districts. So I'll kind of point out a few data points on this handout. You'll see there's a summary for St. Stephen's Indian School, and I'll draw your attention to the column that says snapshot October 2nd, 2017. You'll see for that particular data collection, there were 245 students reported as enrolled. 30 students were not previously enrolled in Wyoming schooling the prior October, so those could be new kindergartners, or they were not in another Wyoming school district or another Fremont school district. The next line where you see B are students that were enrolled in St. Stephen's or any other Wyoming public school the prior year. So that's about 215 students. Continuing down, you'll see the next line is the number of students that were enrolled in St. Stephen's in the prior October. So approximately 175 students, or 71% of the enrollment count, were students that were previously enrolled the prior year. The next line, where you see a zero, are the students who were enrolled in a non-Fremont public school district. So that would be another Wyoming school district. You'll see there were no students counted in that category. And the next section kind of gets to the issue of the mobility. Number three, you'll see the number of students that were enrolled in a Fremont public district the prior year. So there were 40 students, or approximately 16% of the enrollment. And those are further broken down into the districts where those students came from. So you'll see a majority, 25% of those students, or excuse me, 25 of those students came from Fremont 38, 7 came from Fremont 14, and then 8 came from Fremont 25. The next section is just a similar breakout just by grade span. So you'll see those numbers tie out to that 40 count above. And if you look at the prior year, you'll see that there were more students, approximately 60, that were transferring from other Fremont school districts. And then we also did provide a similar analysis for the Fremont public school districts, and you'll see that below. The breakouts are very similar. If you're interested in just kind of the net change, you'll see that for St. Stephen's, they increased enrollment by 60 students that came from other Fremont public school districts for 2016. The Fremont public school districts enrolled 23 students that were previously enrolled in St. Stephen. So the net change there would be 37 students increased to St. Stephen's in 2016.
Interesting. Questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Let's go, Chair.
Yeah, you've given us 100 and some pages of thing to go through, and I've tried as best I can the last few minutes to go through it. Does St. Stephen's have its own school district?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burns, the school district boundaries are the reservation, but they don't have a school district per se that would align with the boundaries. And if you look again in the memo that we provided, the short memo, not the 100 plus page memo, but page 3, some of the proximities. The question was the proximity of St. Stephen's to other public schools. So what I did was include a map of the Fremont public school district boundaries. And you can see that in the middle is Fremont County School District 38. That small section in the middle. The next figure is kind of a depiction of that Fremont 38's boundary. The red marker is St. Stephen's Indian School, and the number 2 is the nearest Wyoming public school, which would be Arapahoe Elementary and Charter High School.
So, Mr. Chairman,
it's a couple of questions. Sure. Follow up. So how is the school board chosen?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burns, I don't know that I have the answer to that. I'm not aware how their school board is elected.
The other question I have is it's supposed to be, you know, from all the high-flying stuff, it's supposed to be for all the Native Americans on the reservation, but everything seems to be geared toward Arapaho, including, first of all, the board. The names that I recognize are all Arapaho names, but there's also talk in here of teaching some of the classes in Arapaho. They recite the Pledge of Allegiance every morning in Arapaho. Where do the Shoshone fit into all this?
Mr. Chairman, I believe you're referring to the annual report that's provided by
the superintendent, by the...
Right, by St. Stephen's.
Like I said, I've gone through it best I can. I'm on page, 60, 78. Page 60, it says they're in the process of adopting the integration of Arapaho culture and language in education into classroom instruction.
Mr. Chairman, I would probably have to defer to the superintendent of St. Stephen's to answer those specific questions about their report. My section provides the fiscal support and helps administer the contract agreement between the department and St. Stephen's.
Okay, I thought you might know better. Sure. Well, you know, you should know better than me anyway.
Mr. Chairman, I would direct you to page 91 of their report, where it talks a little bit about the makeup of their student population, and it does say that their student makeup is comprised of 91% Northern Arapaho tribal members and 7% Eastern Shoshone. So I don't know if that helps answer your question, but that's a little more information in their report on page 91.
I'm just curious about how excited those 7% Eastern Shoshone are reciting the Pledge of Allegiance in Arapaho.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Chairman Burns' question about how they choose their school board, I just went on to their website and looked because I think it's a valid question. All of the other public school districts have a geographic boundary that they choose their boards from. With St. Stephen's, they have the whole reservation, and it says there that the board are comprised of parents and guardians of the current St. Stephen's students. And then they also have a board of directors where that's a WDE school, and it's on there on the parish. So.
Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Jed, thank you for this information. Gentlemen, it's very helpful. I was reading through a little bit of the legislation that was passed up in one of the northern states, and it seems to me to be a little bit more detailed than our Wyoming state statutes. My question to you, Jed, and perhaps to your colleagues in the Department of Education, do you feel like you have everything you need to be able to monitor and provide for the statistics and answers to questions that we ask? Do you have everything you need? Do you have the tools? Do you have the statutes in place that we're doing the right thing over at St. Stephen's?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Landon, I can tell you that since I've been involved with the St. Stephen's program, the requirements through the contract agreements have evolved quite considerably from when it began. We've asked for additional data collections, additional pieces of information to provide the legislature with updates as far as the annual report. We're always looking for ways to improve to be able to answer the questions that you as policymakers have. So if there's some specific areas that you would like us to be able to provide more detailed information, we're open to that. With regards to just some of the oversight, we've had preliminary discussions with St. Stephen's CPA auditors about performing some third-party verification of the revenues that are submitted to the department. We've been exploring ways to validate the membership numbers that are reported at the end of the year, which led to some of the enrollment collections and those type of things. So we're always evolving and trying to improve on the process, and we'd certainly welcome any suggestions you guys might have as far as areas that you'd like to see improved on the data reporting.
Thank you for that, Jed. Are you comfortable with the kinds of responses and cooperativeness of the venture? Do you get what you need?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Landon, St. Stephen's has been very responsive to some of the modifications we've made with the contract agreement. Specifically, we've altered the payment of funds to be tied directly to deliverables at certain times in the year. They've been very accommodating and working with us to make that happen. So to answer your question, yes, I think they've been very responsive to trying to align to some of the requirements of having deliverables met before payment can be generated so that we have the information we need.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jed, do you feel like you can make any comparison between the level of accountability and reporting information between this and the public charter schools that also, I mean, are you able to make any comparison of how much or how little we learn from the two categories?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wilson, I don't know that I can make any connections between the accountability requirements and the reporting of the charter schools. At least for the information, the administration of the funding aspects of charter schools, they're funded in the exact same manner as a public school within a public school district. So we don't have the same requirements as far as developing contracts to get specific data points and to be able to administer the funding. But certainly, I'd be more than happy to talk with our charter school administrators and see if they have any observations or concerns and bring that back.
Further questions? So I appreciate it. So this is, I attended St. Stephen's High School. Back then, there were more nuns and priests than there are these days. And everyone in my family did, and my folks were on the board of directors at one time. So it's got a special place in our family, but we just want to make sure that it's run in such a way that we're getting the best bang for the buck. And we're Eagle's Den, too. Yep. So anyway, appreciate it very much. And Senator Land.
Let me just add a quick comment to that. The co-chairman and I discovered that at some point in our past, I think we played a football game together at St. Stephen's. We came from around the mountain over there in the Representative Summers part of the world, and by golly, I think we played against each other at St. Stephen's. So several of us have some heart in there.
Thank you. Any further questions? With now, we'll take a little short break because then I think we're going into the bills now, and we'll kind of Don, any housekeeping before we do that? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe so.
Okay. Okay, welcome back. We are now moving to proposed legislation, and the first on the agenda is the LSO 0129, which is the Retirement Center and Pioneer Home draft legislation. Representative Larson, why don't you reacquaint us with this bill and the purpose and open up discussion.
So, Mr. Chairman, and I will do a brief summary. The genesis of this bill really goes back about 4 years when the Governor's Task Force on Health Facilities was required to look at all state facilities and reevaluate what their mission was and how it applied in state government. The result of that over the ensuing years is the what we're doing at the State Hospital and Life Resource Center. And at that time, there was a recommendation from the Governor's Task Force that we should look at the Retirement Center and the Pioneer Home because in the scope of things, they really, it could be questioned if they fit the needs to fulfill the mission of the Department of Health. And so, we heard in about 2015 that there was really no appetite to address that issue, legislatively. But over the last couple of years, as we've seen budgets tighten and resources tighten, that has come up again. There was this was brought to our attention again this year when the Departments of Health budget point out that there could be a savings to the Department of Health's budget if the Pioneer Home or the Retirement Center were not in that budget. And the rationale on that is that the Pioneer Home First is an assisted living facility, which currently most areas of the state, in fact, I'd, I would suggest that all areas of the state have access to, and even in Thermopolis. This facility, as you read through the fiscal note, points out that the state is currently subsidizing the operations of this facility about 60% to what the revenue taken in by those who are in assisted living care is. And that was brought to our attention during this budget session from Co-Chairman Burns in asking those why that is. The retirement center is arguably in a similar position in that it is a skilled nursing facility for long-term care. It was originally created as the tuberculosis. And then over the time, the use of that facility has been changed until it became the retirement center, and it was used at one time to place for people with who would have been considered to be dual or hard to place. And the challenges with the retirement center has been getting as a state facility has been getting the psychiatric and skilled professionals there. A lot of that has been done now through traveling, but it provides a service in that area as a long-term care facility, much as you would see in a lot of counties or communities, a nursing home long-term care facility. And so, again, in discussions I've had with the Department of Health at various points is this committee or the legislature comes back to the Department of Health on a regular basis looking for ways to reduce the general funds from their budget, but yet we require them to still fund or subsidize the Pioneer Home in Thermopolis and in the issues in the retirement center in Basin. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I reached out to LSO and said how, if the legislature thought that that was an appropriate thing to do, could we just through the budget bill not fund those two facilities anymore? And the response I got back was no, you can't do it that way because these facilities were created by statute in Title 25, I believe, or maybe, Title 25. Thanks, Stephen. And then they were, the Department of Health was given jurisdiction over them in Title 9. And by just cutting that funding doesn't take away the responsibility of the state or that agency has. And so, Tamara, and she may want to give us some thoughts. She, helped me in kind of looking at different ways that that could be done. And so this bill is a result in, it's kind of at a rudimentary point. It's, that has, I'm sure, as we look at it, there will be suggestions on how we can improve it. But what we really wanted to do was provide you with an understanding of what mechanism has to be in place to allow this to happen. And in essence, you have to go into the Title 25, where it points out that these agencies or that these institutions were created as state institutions, and then you have to. There's some new language that we'll put in there as we go through the bill that says we create a new paragraph in there. That gives a clause that if those institutions are no longer required as a critical, essential to the mission of the department, then they can be disposed of. And I use that term disposed of loosely. That could be construed by many, and I think probably as emotional as this could get, be construed as closure. That is not the intent. The intent is to be taken out of state responsibility and perhaps be put in the local
communities run as a private entity. Then you have to go over to Title 9 and go into that and give a process whereby the director can accomplish this, and he is then required to evaluate his department's mission and determine if these two facilities are critical, or any facilities, we could expand this, or any facility is essential to the mission that he's tasked to fulfill. And if it's not, then he has the ability to make that determination, go to the governor, and make a recommendation. The governor would review that and determine if that recommendation is appropriate or the right thing to do, and would allow then for the disposition of either one, for any facility that is on that list. So in essence, Tamara, have I summarized that in even close to accurate?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I believe that summarizes the direction you gave to me and the discussions we had. I can comment on some of the advice that was provided to you throughout the drafting process and go in through an overview of the bill draft, just depending on what the will of the chairman is.
So with that said, Mr. Chairman, that's kind of the history. And then I would proceed at your direction on how you would like to move forward with the discussion on this.
Any other comments? Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a question of the sponsor. Thanks for all of that information, Representative. I wonder, what's the piece that if a private entity took that over, my understanding is that the Medicare funding rate would not be as high. Why does the state qualify for a higher Medicare reimbursement rate than a private vendor? Am I reading that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, as I read the fiscal note, I caught that as well. And if I may, I could perhaps make that referral back to some of the director's policy analysts, maybe Stefan or Franz. Didn't we have Franz here too? Stefan's here, so if we could, Stefan Johansson from the Department of Health could maybe answer that for us.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Landon, Stefan Johansson, Policy Administrator for the Department. Medicaid reimbursement rates for nursing homes in Wyoming are based on a cost-based rate that's evaluated every so often, I believe, annually. For state-owned facilities, there is a bump in the reimbursement rate on that cost-based reimbursement that you can have for state-owned facilities. And the retirement center is currently the only state-owned nursing home in Wyoming. So it when you look at nursing homes across the state, the retirement center's reimbursement rate is slightly higher. So if the facility were sold or privatized, that reimbursement rate would likely go down. Again, that's variable depending on the cost structure of the facility or the entity that would take it over, but it would likely go down from the state-owned facility reimbursement.
So, Stefan, let's assume that it's a nonprofit, that the local community does kind of something similar to what Saratoga does over in Land or in Riverton. Can you give us a commensurate? I mean, when you say they're a bump, is it a dollar? Is it $15? What is it?
Mr. Chairman, I would have to get back to you on those numbers. I wouldn't want to.
Do you have a rough estimate of the range? I mean,
I don't at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick follow-up to pick up right where you left off. The reason that I ask, obviously, that comes into the negotiations of if we were to privatize, but it also has potential to impact the residents there, and so appreciate the information.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator,
just to remind the body to a little institutional history here. When these facilities were originally set up, they were set up with the idea that was the go-to place for everyone around the state. Well, since then, times have changed, and now every county has their own facility running it just fine in their own counties. And so the circumstances have changed to have one or two state facilities taking care of this. Each county is taking care of it in their respective counties.
Representative Larson.
Mr. Chairman, in fact, to Senator Dockstetter's point, in the task, the governor's task force is, we talked about those two facilities. It was almost kind, if you were looking at equity around the state, then one should perhaps say, if we're going to have state-run facilities here, where should we build the next ones? Because we should provide them to all the residents of the state throughout the state if we're going to provide them in a similar fashion here.
So the I have a couple of questions on the bill itself and suggested language to play with it, but to me it's both a political issue that we have to deal with. And there's a sensitivity issue because we're talking about state employees. I think there's, 31 in Thermopolis and probably a commensurate amount in Basin. And by doing this, they'll essentially be turning into private employees, assuming that they stick around, and benefits and payment scales will be different. And we don't know and Thermopolis will be different because that'll end up – having to be basically a lease type of a program because it's sitting on state properties within a state park. And what I and so what I envision, if the JAC is interested in pursuing this bill, then I'd like to work this bill a little bit more, and we're not going to be able to do that today. But I also like to integrate it in at some additional JAC work. Like perhaps we can meet in Thermopolis and when we do one of our annual meetings during the interim to garner public comment, to explore possibilities and be a little bit more instructive on both what the Department of Health's report will include and have a little deeper conversation on the private partner, public partnership and how it could work. And the effect, you know, because really this is kind of a bare-bones bill that simply says Department of Health, you're allowed to do it. But in terms of to actually effectuating it, I think there'll be more work, more hands-on participation by certain committee members and by it may even be a select group that goes out and determines the most cost-efficient but also the most if you will, kind of a humane and sustaining effort so that we just don't turn it over to anybody. And so there's just a lot more homework involved in the process over time. The bill basically takes care of the constitutional statutory issues. I think there'll be a lot more on top of that. And if we do these in tandem, the overall effect, I think, will happen in a more kind of a steadied march forwards, so we're in and also more in a public process. And so there are ways to do it. And so the question is to the committee, do we want to take this bill and adopt it as ours in this concept and continue to work on it or not? And so I'd open it up for discussions with the committee, and because if we're not going to do it, there's no reason to waste more of our time and effort here today. So,
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Dockstetter.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple of things there. Healthcare facilities, and I surely welcome the continued public input and to go continue the process there, but for the body, healthcare facilities has been there. I can recall two occasions in public hearings that we had there. So we were laying the groundwork. We just weren't saying, oh, we're going to do this. As far as committee assignment, in the environment we're living in now with less money than there is to take care of the state's expenses, this seems like the logical committee to address this with. Thank you.
Senator Driscoll.
I feel exactly the same. I think the timing's right, and it's high time, and this committee is the right place to take a hard look at it, do it balanced, do it fair, and take a look not only at the state employees but at the patients. I think that's one thing we're going to have to deal with is rates are somewhat different than private homes, and we've got people that are there for that reason. We're going to have to deal a little bit with the patients that are there as well.
Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I share the sentiments of Senator Driscoll. I really think it's the right thing for us to do, and I appreciate your thoughts with regard to this bill not quite being all the effort that needs to go in there. My biggest concern is those residents of those facilities and making sure that whatever we do, we do so in a humane way. Hadn't really thought a lot about those state employees. I mean, and bless their hearts, I've toured that facility with Labor and Health, and they do a wonderful job in those places. So well thought out, and I think it's worth pursuing. I think we owe it to ourselves. The comment by Representative Larson that we're subsidizing there and we're not subsidizing anywhere else, that's paramount.
For example, if you look at the fiscal note and the cost of operating Basin, it's not all that. I don't think the fiscal note's accurate. I think it left out some components of it, but that's something that we could have also explore, a management company coming in and manage state employees and keep them as state employees as an alternative. I mean, just something we have to explore so they can have efficiencies but still do it as alternative as it need to be explored. But comments from the House side.
I think it's really important we do this over an interim, and I think it'd behoove us to involve the Health Committee, for example. I think we could have a co-meeting or something when we hit that area, and I think that would help kind of the whole – I mean, they've been involved for a long time on this issue as well. So I just think it's – we need to slow up and do it in a more thoughtful manner and just proceed to that point.
And to that end, Health Committee has toured it. Judiciary Committee has toured it all. So I've been at these facilities, some of them twice. So it's been a process that's been ongoing for – a while. But once again, we got to do it right. So, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify, so looking at like page 4 where it talks about the determination component, is the vision then to kind of have that be the end point of this particular bill, and then in the next session, this committee, or I don't know if health facilities, can they sponsor bills themselves? But as far as if the determination is to go ahead, then the process of setting up an RFP and such like would be for a subsequent bill. I mean, is that what we're most likely aiming at as the most sensible approach?
Representative Larson?
I think that there's some real merit with moving forth in full respect of what Representative Summers says, I think that there's some real merit in moving forth with providing the mechanism that makes this whole thing possible. Now, whether the legislature or the Department of Health chooses to do that, that would be an end result of interim discussions on the need for such facilities, how it's accomplished, to whom it would be with, but we would have in place kind of the statutory mechanism that would allow it to happen. But having we'd have to play with this bill a little bit to make sure that we're not sending the cart out in front of the horse in as far as the process goes. For moving that, in essence, really requiring the Department of Health to get started on making a recommendation. If that's the will of the legislature of this committee, so be it. But fundamentally, to provide the statutory ability for this to happen, I think is probably a thing that is worthy of effort this year.
So then taking that in, then, on page 4 there, as far as the disposition, I mean, we would need to have pretty significant, I mean, to my mind, amendment as far as And further instruction on setting up some sort of an RFP process, which we wouldn't be saying you shall do this, but subject to the determination, because, you know, when we looked at the budget, and our discussion at the time was to put in, 1 year's worth of the savings, but, so that would be starting in July of 2019, and I don't think it's realistic for us to just go up to the determination and then in the next session have some bill authorizing the specific RFP type process to actually be accomplished by July. I do think it makes a lot of sense that we need to put, the if this, then this is the structure for going forward in this bill, so that it could be moving by January 1 and actually pick up the half budget year by July 1.
Representative Larson.
So, Mr. Chairman and Representative Wilson, I think that Section 2, if this committee chose to move forward with it, I think the critical components to be carried forward would be in Section 1, getting the statute changed, and then probably give some guidance in Section 2 on how you would like the Department of Health or legislative lead to proceed. But I think, to the chairman's point, is this a concept, something that this committee wants to look at, and not to not trying to do it all here today, but to basically determine if we want to make this committee bill, if I understood you correct, Mr.
Yeah,
Chairman.
And I would just say that I'm comfortable that, but by the time this bill hits prime time in middle of February, if it comes out of this committee, we'll have a bill that we will be comfortable with. That I just don't think it'll be that difficult. So,
just following up on that, I definitely think it should be somebody's committee bill. I mean, this is a significantly weighty subject matter that I don't think we should lay it on some individual's shoulders.
You can see my amendments that I've already got written on my so far.
Well, you can carry it if you want, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I just, in the world of making sure that we're running a state that's living within its means, I would suggest that this is the committee that we work on such things with this piece of legislation.
Okay,
Mr. Chairman,
a motion that this bill, or the concept of this bill, be a committee bill of the JAC. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I've always been a little concerned about this aspect of this, I don't know if you call it stepping on toes, but the Labor Health Committee oversees this particular area, and I don't know that we necessarily I think I'm going to vote against this simply because I have not had a chance to consult with the chairman of that committee.
And Mr. Chairman, Tamara Revely, before the committee takes a vote, I think I have a duty to discuss a little bit about what the bill does and what it does not do, if that
sure
would be acceptable.
Never stopped us before.
So again, Mr. Chairman, Tamara Revely, the premise of this bill was that it would open the door to a variety of different outcomes, but that what that outcome was is not known today, whether it's privatization, what that privatization might look like, or whether it's something else, or continued operation. So this was really, like I said, a mechanism to open the door and to allow for things to move forward this session. There's still going to need to be some cleanup legislation in any regard. There's several areas that the bill simply does not address. If it is known today exactly what the outcome is going to be, then this legislature, this committee, could sponsor legislation to very specifically dictate how everything's going to be handled. But some of those issues that at some point will need to be addressed is other references to these institutions in state statute. provisions that appoint representatives to the institutions to sit on the Department of Health's Advisory Council on Aging. Then the entire Chapter A of Title 25 that authorizes the Department of Health to operate these facilities. Provisions that address how special purpose gifts will be used up or handled. Provisions that address how the Wyoming Retirement Center special revenue account will be directed, and possibly also provisions that address how authorized employee positions might be handled, and potentially provisions that contemplate what privatization or whatever else is taken looks like, what that means for those residents. So I think that the cleanest method of moving forward with changing state institutions into some other mechanism is to have a bill draft for the legislature and whatever other entities to make an affirmative decision to come back and affirmatively draft a bill to take care of all the statutes that need to be conformed and to specify how everything will be handled. Absent that, this was an approach to try to allow for a mechanism to open the door for different outcomes this session.
So just to summarize, Tamara, this bill simply is a mechanism to that's going to require further legislation, whether it comes from this committee and or for health or some other source, to effectuate whatever roads we ultimately determine to go down on each facility.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, as far as I know, this is not an approach that's been used in the past to facilitate privatization.
I don't know if we've done it much in the past. Senator Astor, do you have any comments?
Mr. Chairman, it's just I had felt that I was in agreement with, I think it was Representative Summers that said, looking at this in the interim, and that just solidified it from in my perspective. I have a lot of concerns over where this is going to go and then piecemealing, you know, aspects of it, not really completely understanding the dynamics. And I'm sure over time, I guess we could, you know, what are the capacities and percentages of capacities for filling the determinations and of effectiveness. And in my mind, there's more than, you know, our responsibility, as legislators goes further than just fiscal, and so there's a lot of concerns for me.
Representative Larson.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just share personally one of the reasons I like the approach that this kind allows us to do is really a result of the State Health Facility Task Force work that we've done as we started looking at how that should roll out. We just didn't have enough knowledge to begin with to just do the draft language and get it all done at one time. We came in, I think, 3 different years facilitating different changes in statutes to accommodate what we finally ended up with for those facilities. And so, I will share with you that this is my intent here was to take a cautious, well thought out approach. But there has to be, at the end of the day, there kind of has to be a mechanism there that allows us to even move forward. Whether that mechanism's ever used would be up to just the bodies of the legislature.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dockstad.
This is not an easy task, and I appreciate the chairman saying let's make sure that we have everything taken care of properly in order. It's not new. Healthcare Facilities has been working on this very issue for several years, trying to decide how do we move it into the system. It's reached that point now where we've got an anomaly. We've got all of these counties with their retirement centers, similar facilities out there running them on their own. And here we have this state facility that's being supported on its own, but but really isn't reaching out to the whole state. As I recall in our studies, the residents there were from that particular area. I would suggest that it's time, whether we move it through this committee or another. I would prefer this committee because it is the committee that deals with the overall financial picture. I think we can consult very, very much with the health committee, but this is the committee that, and we don't want to be cold about it, but this is the committee that has to run things financially secure. We have to make sure that we're doing the right thing financially for the state. We're not going to turn people away. We're going to be careful with their jobs, but it's reached a point, members of this committee, that it has to be addressed. We can't keep kicking this one down the road. I would suggest that we carefully move forward. If this is the bill that we need to do it with to start the process, or we need to create something with Tamara's help that's a little more detailed, then fine. But at this point, I think it's time to move it forward, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let's Representative Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Essentially, I agree with what Senator Dockstader said. I think we need to move this forward. I have some concern about how we manage this in terms of committees. Having served on labor health, I to exclude them would be totally inappropriate. I don't think that's anybody's intent. But there are a lot of healthcare services related with any decision we make that I think they're in a better position to evaluate. So I think that'll be a decision to be determined. But my inclination at the moment is perhaps they are the primary and we deal with the financial implications.
Representative Somers.
So, Mr. Chairman, you know, my biggest concern with this bill is it really does state in Romanet 1 and 2 that things can cease. And I think what I really would rather see is an joint interim study by this committee and health, you know, and the health committee on how to do this, on how do we close this down and turn it over to a private facility. And I'm not sure that's not what where we're going, but it's really not. I don't read that in this bill. So,
well, and that wouldn't necessarily be in the bill. Like that's more likely to be a directive of Management Council, and just schedule Health and JAC to meet at one location and address those issues. I mean, there's lots of ways to get that done. So,
you know, including. Really appreciated the idea from Representative Schwartz. I share that, having served on labor and health myself, and we could certainly think about a task force, too. You know, I don't know that it takes both joint interim committees meeting in the same spot at the same time. We might consider just a couple of representatives off of the two committees and combining, you know, with some executives to get some of the work done, too.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, I think, to me, this is the committee that should do this. If there's one thing this committee does and I think is good at, regardless of what you might think, is making decisions. The committee in the past has made specific decisions to move the state forward in a number of areas, in retirement, in the healthcare facilities, work, and that. And I think this is the committee where it should reside at this time. Like I said, this committee does one thing well, which is to make decisions. People may not agree with them, but we do move things forward. And I would say, I think everyone knows my position on doing innumerable studies, which is we have the information, move forward.
Well, and I can say that having served on the Health Task Force Committee, when we met, it was the task force conclusion that this needed to happen. But what the task force recognized was it's a more of a political, difficult decision to perform,
and that the first priority was the Life Resource Center and the state hospital, which is what then we directed our attention to and which is now going out to bid and is in the process of being bid, and we'll be start building new buildings for that. And so, and we've also, this issue has been in front of the labor committee, and with really, I think, concurrence of what needs to happen, but with no directives on where to go with it. So once again, all we're doing is bringing everything into one basket so that we can act reasonably, judiciously, and fairly to everybody. But I don't think there's anyone at the end of the day that doesn't realize that this is something, if depending on or what our goals and objectives are, it's probably a road we need to go down. So with that, let's take a motion to adopt the bill, and then if there's anyone that wants, once we do that, then we can take some public comment on if anyone wants to, if the people are here for it.
Second.
So moved and second that the House bill for the Retirement Center Pioneer Home, which is 0129, draft 1.1, be a committee bill for the JAC. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
That motion carries. And now, Tamara, I don't think we need to walk through the bill, but I would like to open it up to public discussion if there's anyone here who, just because this has been on the agenda, and if anyone would like to address the issue that's here today. All right. Seeing none, we'll close public discussion. So, in moving a step forward, my guess is this is going to be a House bill. So, what I would recommend is that we'll play with this bill a little bit and recirculate prior to February, and then when we first meet, like one of our first meetings at JAC, and if there's any comments, we'll get those circulated and out so that we've got a version that that we can discuss in our first meeting when the session starts. Is everyone comfortable with that? So,
yes.
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Let's go on to the next bill.
Mr. Chairman, just a point of process. We'll need to meet either that first day or the morning of the second day in order to meet the timelines.
Okay. Local government distribution, is that next up? This is House Bill 0213. So, Don, you want to just provide us some background on this bill, what it does, or someone?
Mr. Chairman, 18 LSO 0213, formal draft 1.1, is an identical piece of legislation that came out of the 2016 session. It provides for a $105 million distribution in two equal payments for both fiscal years, updated with the most recent information for each year. This is the same amount and the identical formula that was used in the previous biennium. The governor's profile included $105 million. We did not receive a letter from the governor for funding for local governments.
And my question is there a reason to put it in a bill versus putting in the budget?
And what's been the practice? What's happened in the past?
Mr. Chairman, prior to the 2016 LSO memo, this local government direct distribution, as well as community or consensus funding for counties, was included within a Section 300 of the budget. Upon review of the Constitution by LSO legal staff, they note that the budget bill shall only include general operations, appropriations for the general operations of state government, and makes no mention of local government. As a result, we pulled that out into a separate bill since that memo.
And so then to effectuate the same effect, this is basically a two-year bill, and it only survives the next biennium. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. It would provide for payments in fiscal year 19 and fiscal year 20.
Further discussions on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, question for staff. Don, you said it was identical to the previous bill. Is the formula identical?
Mr. Chairman, the formula is identical. However, the data driving the formula is updated each year. So okay. Even though the formula is static, you can expect changes in terms of the outcomes based upon actual sales and use tax and actual assessed valuations. The Revenue Committee did look at the formula and, in fact, considered changes due to the cost of government in counties, for example, and noted that any changes would be de minimis and elected not to make any revisions to the components of the model.
Mr.
Co-Chair.
When did Revenue Committee change this formula last? Was it last biennium?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Last biennium was the first opportunity for distribution of local funds under this formula.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don, question. You said annually. So, excuse me, for fiscal year 20, then it is recalculated on how much the entities get, correct?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don, I have it in my mind that this came out of revenue, and then it went through some gyrations during the session, and we kind of had it before the House, as we referred to it as the Madden formula. That got tweaked, and I think, is that not the what we used and is in this bill?
Mr. Chairman, you are correct. This is the as-adopted formula for the 17-18 biennium. While the concept was initiated by the chairman on the House side of the Joint Revenue Committee, it was amended throughout the process, and it was, I would argue, substantively amended on the Senate side by the minority leader.
Representative Somers.
Mr. Chairman, there's no magic behind where the revenue source is, being the LISRA in this bill. That could be the general fund or wherever we decided to, if we decided to fund. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. And, in fact, the governor's profile suggests an appropriation from the general fund.
Well, we don't have any money in the general fund right now. We've used it.
Thank you. And, Don, could you just refer me to and maybe help me? I was thinking that there was a multiplier or something that referred to small communities, and I'll use the term hardship. Where is that reference in here? There's a calculation to determine how communities qualify for that. I think that enables them to get their 10 grand or something.
Mr. Chairman, bottom of page 3.
Bottom of page 3.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, Matt Sackett with LSO. Are you referring to the municipal hardship distribution?
Yes, please.
The municipal hardship distribution is outlined starting on the bottom of page 7, you will see under subparagraph M, double I, from the amounts available, from the section, each city or town shall receive amounts in accordance with the city and town revenue challenged. Revenue challenged and hardship are generally used interchangeably for these local government distributions. Starting there, going on to the to sub A, is the, where the lowest quartile amount is then calculated. On to page 8 is the kind of full description of how the quartile is calculated.
Thank you. I was just that sufficient for what I needed. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was a question about the source of the funding. On the top of page 2, paragraph A, it does say from the LISRA for it, at current language.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, and it is illustrative of how this funding was funded in the 17-18 biennium.
So I think the next procedurally, I think we'll take a vote on whether or not this is going to be, we're going to adopt this bill and it's going to be a JC bill, or are we already there?
Wouldn't hurt.
All right. Do we have a motion? Been moved and seconded that the House Bill 0213, Draft 1.1, Local Government Distribution, become a JAC committee bill. For any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That motion carries. Any further discussion? I know that there's some few folks here that may want to have a address the bill. We don't want to limit this, so we're not here for an hour and a half, so please keep your comments succinct, and we kind of, particularly if we've already heard it once or twice. So with that, I think we'll open it up to public discussion. And please come forward, identify yourself and pros and cons on the bill, and if if there are any.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chairman, and members of the committee, of Rick Caseman with the Wyoming Association of Municipalities, as you heard earlier this week, the need for the minimum amount of $105 million for local governments.
You mean maximum amount, don't you?
If we can settle on 105 maximum or minimum, I think that is great. But again, for your 99 incorporated municipalities in 23 counties, these dollars, as I've shared before, go to these communities, go to these municipalities and counties, and for those services for the Wyoming citizens. So, again, respectfully request that we keep the $105 million. It's a challenge. I recognize that. But as I've stated as well, challenges for our municipalities and our county. So try to answer any questions you may have, sir.
Thanks, Rick. Representative Summers.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. You see a future out there in the near future where this isn't necessary? Is this going to be an ongoing ask forever and all time?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, until there are some modifications to state statutes that would allow, and I'm speaking for municipalities this time, for the ability to have own source capacity or also known as generating revenues from within, yes, I believe you will see municipalities leaning on state aid until there is some relief in another fashion.
What's so magic about this $105 million?
Okay. Mr. Chairman and Mr. Co-Chairman, the $105 million is no more or no less than what we have been granted in this current biennium. It is an amount that I have talked with municipal leaders that will allow them to continue in the next biennium, keeping in mind that their costs continue to increase. And as I have also shared with this committee, much like state agencies, municipalities have gone through their cleaning as well with regards to efficiencies, reductions in workforce, reductions in hours in some respective communities. I just learned 2 days ago, for example, the town of Fannie no longer has a police chief.
Franny,
excuse me. So there are some have been some significant adjustments that have been made. So the $105 million is the amount that, based on our experiences the last 2 years, or including this year, is the amount that we'll be able to continue to move forward.
Mr. Chairman?
Follow up. This $105 million has been a static figure for about 6 or 8 years now, and at the same time, the state government, we've been cutting, I think we're up to about 13 to 15% that we've actually cut out of the budget, state budget, so I don't understand why you would expect this amount to stay the same and not be cut along with all the other state agencies.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Co-Chairman, the $105 million has not been a static number, if I may, sir. Just a few years ago, local governments was blessed with $175 million in direct distributions during the very good revenue years. And those dollars have been decreased. As in comparison, the last five bienniums, local governments' overall direct distribution has been reduced by just a little bit shy of 30% as an aggregate number. As well, as you'll recall, we've lost the county consensus funds, which has hurt on some of our capital projects and that. So there have been deductions, there have been reductions in local government funding.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman. Just maybe Johnson. A little institutional history, Mayor. As I recall, every year there was a $20 million add-on too onto this 105 too, so there's actually a little bit more. So essentially you're kind of coming back down. And as a follow-up to that, you've been to virtually every region. You were with us in the southwest part of Wyoming. We brought all the towns together in one room there in Kemmer. You've got unanimous support at 105. Nobody's going to come back and ask us for any more beyond that?
For this biennium?
We're looking to lock in here, Mr.
Yeah, understood, sir. Mr. Chairman, Senator Dockstetter, again, this is what we have brought forward. This is what we have asked respectfully. And at this point in time, yes, I do not anticipate coming forward from, again, direct distribution. There may be other needs for folks on emergency basis, what have you, but for the general operations and what this $105 million provides, I do not anticipate coming forward.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you referenced that if the legislature would give municipalities capacity to find revenues on their own, what mechanisms do you foresee they would pursue?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Schwartz, I would ask you to refer to our Municipal Finance Report Volume 2, which we published and presented in September of 2017. Each legislature did receive a copy of that. It's also on our website. But in there are some recommendations that were presented to the Joint Revenue Committee during the 2017 interim session. For example, a municipal tax. A municipal tax would allow a municipality to put a ballot measure in front of their residents, their voters, that says, much like we have with our optional taxes today, we need a specific amount of money for a specific amount of time for a specific purpose. The voters would go forward and say nay or yay at the voting time. This is a municipal tax option is a mechanism that is used across other states. I have cited to the Joint Revenue Committee a couple of examples. Mobile, Alabama, Commerce City, Colorado, just south of us, where they've used these over the years. The key here is to put it in front of the voters for their decision. We put some other ideas or thoughts in there with regards to the concurrent optional taxes. This one is not overly popular, but and with our friends at the Wyoming County Commissioners Association, but we currently have, excuse me, the fifth penny optional tax. That's provided by statute. It goes in front of the voters every 4 years in respective counties combined with municipalities. If that was made permanent by legislative action and verifying numbers with the Department of Revenue, that would be about $95 million that would be added to it. It's another mechanism saying if we added one more percent to sales and use taxes. But so again, within that report, and again with respect to the time, there are other options that are referenced.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the challenges that I've that comes with allowing the locals to do options, and I have to tell you that I somewhat support that idea, but sitting on this committee, we find that we give that option available to boards and to other entities, and rather than impose that upon themselves, they like to come back to the state and have others fill the empty barrels that might exist. And so with that precursor, my concern is if we allow that, what do we do for those municipalities or counties, however that's broken up, that choose not to and find themselves in a predicament? Do we then just say, tough Rockos, you have the ability to impose a tax upon yourself and you've elected not to, so live with what you got? I just want to make sure that everybody has a clear understanding of what the consequences would be if they chose not to impose, if the voters elected not to impose those and found themselves in kind of a financial predicament. What then would the state's responsibility be?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, that question has been asked several times, and it's a very valid question. We've had that discussion internally as well. If I may point to some of our smaller towns who do not even have perhaps the ability to generate own source capacity, they do not have a tax base, they do not have retail stores. So again, our smaller towns, and as you'll remember, there's over 50% of our municipalities have a population of 500 or less. So again, those communities would continue to be challenged. They would probably still be in need of state assistance.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, a follow-up, please. And we understand that. I guess my question is pointed more at the norm. Take those entities that have the ability and elect not to find themselves. The officials may want to, but the voters choose not to, and then find themselves in a predicament. What? I know there's anomalies and there's small, come to Fremont County, we have a few of those and we get that, and we would want to help them be able to sustain themselves. But what about those that can and choose not to through the election process, the voter process? What has been your discussion on how that's approached?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, the discussion has been more of an evolving response to that type of question is how will these things work out? I cannot sit here and tell you this is how it's going to work out. I would make the assumption, underscored assumption, that state aid, state assistance is still going to be required even by the larger populated communities as well. So there's a lot of options, but it would be an evolving type of construct, if I may, to see how this may work or may not work.
Mr. Chairman, if state aid to locals is going to be an ongoing expense of state government, there's been an idea floated out there that, perhaps right now it's a 69% general fund, 31% to locals for sales and use tax distribution. So what if that switch went to 65-35 and that 4% were put in a fund that was a local government distribution fund, and then it was distributed according to whatever formula people can fight over. Okay. So if what's the idea of actually, if we're going to and of course that would only generate about, I think, $51.8 million. But what's your thoughts behind, at least for a biennium or something, institutionalize the idea that you guys are a drain on the general fund, so should we recognize that?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, yes, that option of adjusting that percentage or the ratio or the percentage split was also addressed in our municipal finance report, Volume 2. And so if those dollars, if there's a percentage that can be adjusted where there's more revenues coming into local government, that would be something we are interested in. But we're also cognizant what that means to state agencies of what they, you know, the impact that may have with reductions on their portion of the percentage right now.
Well, if we did that, you'd probably be an offset in the 105, and so I don't know that the ultimate impact would be. It's just more of a guaranteeing a source. So. Right. Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I look through our historical financial data information since 2000 and the 99-2000 era and earmarking today to today, it shows that municipalities, cities, towns, counties, et cetera, are to the positive of about $750 million as where they would have stood had we left things in place and the distributions prior to those actions. Just some of your thoughts on that. I guess the way I read it, you're doing quite well because of the state's contributions to your activities. And so, like I said, I'd just like to hear some of your thoughts on that matter.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Walters, I think that is representative of the very positive revenue dollars that the state has been able to realize in past years. But again, things have changed drastically, as you have lived with and you know every day. So again, municipal governments were very grateful, and we benefited during those rich years. But we are now at a point in time where they're not the rich years.
Further questions? If not, thank you.
Thank you, and I'm sure I went beyond the time that you were expecting.
When it's our fault, it's okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm just going to turn it over here real quick to Commissioner Bill Novotny from Johnson County, who is the chairman of our Revenue Committee, for a couple of brief remarks. Then I have a couple answers to some of the questions that you asked already.
Good morning, members of JAC, and I appreciate the opportunity to reiterate the position of the counties, which is for level funding at the $105 million. That translates to about $300,000 for Johnson County. What we do with that is provide critical services, whether it's law enforcement, Title 25, you know, those dollars that trickle down that are actually generated in my county first through the mineral production, sent down here and then sent back are substantially less than what we send down. So we do appreciate that small allocation of the funds that do come back to us to allow for critical services for our people. We are not asking for any more funding, as we realize across the state and across your agencies, you're faced with difficult cuts. The good co-chairman from Sheridan County alluded to cuts within state agencies. My budget has been cut over 30%. I've eliminated 25 positions in the last 2.5 years through a hiring freeze, early retirement program, and actually some layoffs and consolidation of positions. So we're also feeling the pain. But the responsibilities that we have, whether they are mandated through state law, federal laws, and even the state constitution, doesn't change our responsibilities. And so as additional costs for things like WildLink, prevention services that were previously done through a contract that are now going to be negotiated to be sent through public health, even things like the university pushing onto the county's additional responsibilities for the retirement and benefits of 4-H agents who receive a better retirement package through the university than what I can offer my county employees. We're filling the cut, whether it's through loss of revenues locally or unfunded or underfunded mandates that we're receiving from the state in addition to the responsibilities that we have in our day-to-day operations. So, again, I appreciate consideration of full funding of this request for 105, and I would defer to our very capable executive director.
Well, and we appreciate that, and particularly your county. We've all seen the numbers. That you have the most ups and downs of anybody, so tough place, although a hard place to buy a home there about 2 years ago.
Mr. Chairman, just a couple additional thoughts, and then happy to take questions. adding on a statewide perspective to Co-Chairman Burns' question about, why it is we feel like we don't deserve a cut, I would just reiterate that what Commissioner Novotny's experience in Johnson County is statewide. Over the past 3 years, total intergovernmental funding from the state, which includes all state-shared sources to local government, is down 30%. 2 years ago, of course, this body eliminated the $75 million in consensus grants. Last year, this body eliminated $5 million in our local government capital construction account that will be biennialized. So cuts are happening both on our own sources of funding and from this body year after year after year. So we are taking part in the cuts, and as we go, you go. That's true in good times. It's true in bad times. And so to Representative Larson's appropriate questions about what do we do when our voters say no, I think in general our members' attitude is if the voters say no, the voters say no, and we live within our means. That's why you've seen our general statewide county employment levels remain flat even in good years. And it's down now because there's more examples than Commissioner Novotny's examples about layoffs and cuts at positions at the county level. Our attitude is we're given a lot of authority to put things out to the voters. It seems pretty clear that the voters have drawn a line at six pennies. No county has ever gone beyond six pennies because their voters have said no in any way. The fact that we have seven penny available, it's great. No voter in any county has ever let us go that far. It is what it is, and we're willing to deal with that. And then finally, in the last thought, Mr. Chairman, on Representative Summers' question, I think you would find among my members, I may be speaking out of school here, but I think you would find among my members a great willingness to discuss a way that we could fairly replace a direct distribution, discretionary allocation with something more permanent like you're talking about. The challenge has been that the distributions are different, as you well know. I think we have some suggestions on how to overcome that. But we would certainly be willing to discuss that further.
So, Mr. Chairman, it would seem you could create a fund and divert that money into a fund, right? That extra diversion, if it was 4%, and then out of that fund, you could distribute according to whatever formula was decided upon in the end. Is that a fair way? I mean, we divert now, right? So we divert $105 million now to somewhere in the state lands office, and then they make a split. There's no other reason you couldn't create a fund and divert into that and then distribute accordingly. Would you see a reason that that couldn't happen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers, that's one way to do it. One of the challenges that we face in an association, of course, is with respect to sales tax revenue and property tax revenue. That is locally generated. The idea of taking that revenue and redistributing that to other places presents a challenge to us as an association. It's not to say we can't overcome it, but I think that's why an idea like that has run into some headwinds. There are other ways to do it that involve using the direct distribution, the discretionary distribution from you as a backstop that would be where it would be reduced, offset, as the chairman said, dollar for dollar in a different split like that. There are ways to get around that problem is what I'm trying to say, and we're certainly open to it. What has hindered us in the past is the difference in distribution, and that creates different winners and losers in the current formula.
Further questions? All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Any other public comment? It's just nice to see that Laramie's so well represented here, Lenny.
Well, the front door of the state.
Honorable Chairman, I had no intention to speak, but I was inspired by Mr. Obermueller on something he said, and I wanted to add just a few very brief comments. You guys have heard all of the things from Laramie before, and I have no desire to repeat them again. But what I do want to say is, as an elected official, this is not fun. trying to figure out how to fund your cities and towns. Right now we're in a partnership, and it's difficult right now to plan and budget. And if I had to lay out a utopia, it would be a solution to this problem which involves some stability and guaranteed revenue, something along the lines of what was just discussed. But that doesn't put cities and towns and counties pitted against each other, so you get away from the idea of winners and losers from formulas. I would challenge this committee to get out of the business of formulas and get out of the business of having this fight every 2 years. It's not fun to any of us that are here, and it doesn't – I don't think it's any fun for anybody. So I just want to put that challenge out there. As an elected official, I think we could look for solutions and work along the lines – where we can provide stable funding to provide credit so the cities and towns can provide critical services without having this fight every 2 years. That's it. That's all I want to say today. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other public comment? Okay, well, we'll close public comment on that. Any further action from this committee?
Move the bill.
Didn't we do that?
Yeah.
I thought we did. Yeah, I think we. Yeah.
We voted to make it a JC bill.
Okay. Well, move the bill then. Move and second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries. So this will be a JAC bill. Where do you want it to land to start with? About time you guys took one of them.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's assuming the bill passes.
True.
If the bill passes, we'll take it as a Senate. And put our tender mercies on it.
So, Don?
Mr. Chairman, are you going to work the bill, take amendments?
Sure. We can do so. We just did. So, we can work the bill then, because I think we just moved and adopted it. Who's going to work us through the bill?
Yeah. I mean, Mr. Chairman, we're open to amendments if there are.
Are there any amendments?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Co-Chair?
I've got a couple of amendments.
Let me go back to the bill.
One of them, the first one, I don't know exactly where it goes.
You want us to tell you where to go?
You wouldn't be the first. I'm gonna need Tamara to help, but we'll make it an amendment in concept. And the motion is to deduct or either deduct or lessen the amount of money going to any particular county that has not joined the county emergency suppression fund, fire suppression fund, by the amount that they would ordinarily pay into it.
So, Mr. Co-Chair, my question is that something that the counties have the ability to do between now and the implementation of this bill?
Yes. My understanding is this bill becomes effective July 1st.
Correct. So, and we're talking about Sweetwater County and Campbell County. Those are the only two that have not joined it.
I don't want to mention any specific counties.
We might as well be upfront about what we're doing. So, it's been moved and seconded. Discussion.
Is it reasonable? I mean, we're fortunate enough to have a Campbell County commissioner here. Maybe he would have some, and a Sweetwater. Maybe they would want to help us understand the rationale behind their position on that.
Mr.
Chairman, if I may, we cuss the county to the east of us. We don't claiming them. So, no, I can't. They invade our favorite fishing holes in our mountains.
So. Mr. Chairman, the idea here is basically to encourage the counties sure. to all join the Emergency Fire Suppression Fund. It acts as a as an insurance policy for the rest of us, for all of us in these two counties have chosen not to join. I think the little encouragement, little nudge would help.
I think it's a pretty good nudge. Don, I have a question. If we stuck, we could also stick that in as a budget footnote, could we not?
Mr. Chairman, it's much easier to accomplish in this bill.
Easier for you, maybe.
In the budget, you will have to identify some yeah. other distribution.
True. Senator Lana.
Mr. Chairman, just for a point of clarification, if I remember testimony that we received over the past week or so, and speaking neither on or against the motion, I'm trying to remember that those counties reimburse in full any expenses borne by the state. Isn't that the testimony that we heard?
No. The testimony that, as I recall it, is they reimburse any private citizen who is damaged by a fire. That's my recollection of the testimony.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess I was still not clear on the cost to the system that if Campbell and Sweetwater counties aren't participating, that there wasn't. I thought the testimony was there wasn't a cost or an expense generated. And I understand what you're saying is that not all are participating, that the fund was set up to reimburse for private property fires. And that if the county's taking care of that on their own in their own county without the assistance of the others, where's the drain? Or I guess where's...
Mr. Chairman, the state still pays for fire suppression or fighting fires on state land. Anywhere and everywhere. Them not participating is actually an incentive for other counties to not participate. And then, and frankly, it's a couple of the threads that could unravel the entire thing.
So I suppose the real question is this something that belongs in this type of bill? Or
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Co-Chair.
This is money that the counties and cities are asking us for free and clear. There are no other conditions on it. I see no reason not to give them a little bit of gentle persuasion. And if they still choose not to do it, fine. All they lose is the money that otherwise would have been contributed. They would have contributed to the county suppression fund.
Okay, I think we all understand the motion. The issue is it's a concept motion. Any comments from LSO?
Mr. Chairman, I think maybe a couple clarifications. There's the county and municipal distribution. Is this just to the county distribution?
Just to the county distribution.
And maybe a second follow-up, Mr. Chairman, would be if money was then not taken by the – they were reduced, where would that money then be redistributed through the formula?
Mr. Chairman, that's a good question. It would be redistributed into the formula for all the other counties.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So do we know offhand what the amounts are for those two counties?
Mr. Chairman, we do not.
Thank you. May I, Mr. Chair?
Please.
Yeah, that's not the only number I would actually want before I could knowledgeably vote on this, because it's not just about what the contribution will be, but when I was a commissioner, my county did join this, but it's kind of based on your thinking in terms of actuarials, essentially. And I don't know what the instance of fires that would have fallen into this category in these two counties are, and on what basis they're making, what financial basis they're making that decision, because there's clearly a risk to the counties as well. So I'm a little hesitant to move forward without having a little clearer idea of what the numbers are.
So it looks like we have Campbell County as 115,000. We don't have Sweetwater's number. Further questions for 115? Is what Representative Burkhardt's notes have.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, my notes indicate that Campbell is the highest yearly assessment, so Sweetwater would be a little less.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
please.
Part of the calculation that's done, and it is a, you know, for instance, I'll use my home county, Sheridan. We don't really have a lot of state land compared to a lot of other counties, and we don't have a lot of federal land compared to a lot of other counties. But we still participate in this just like every other county. It's one of these all, you know, all for one kind of situations, and it bothers me that these two counties decided, no, we don't want to do this.
Mr. Chairman, I think the state pays for the state's portion of fire on their land. It's not.
Yes, they do.
This isn't about that.
No, it's not about that at all.
Okay.
Further questions on the motion? Okay, it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
That motion fails. You got another motion?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It was to lower it from 105 million to 90 million.
A motion to lower the total amount from 105 to 90 million. Is there a second?
Second.
The move and second in discussion.
Mr. Chairman, the state is looking at diminishing savings, and if you know, this committee is doing everything it can to cut back on expenditures so that we don't end up spending ourselves off a cliff in the next 4 years or so when our savings run out. And I think that the cities and counties, frankly, have to prepare themselves for the same eventuality.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Doxer.
I think the cities and counties are our front line, and they've already told us that they've already been making those cuts. And I'd be opposed to the motion.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Huster.
Mr. Chairman, I'm on and against. It's been my personal opinion that in the times of the economic downturn that we shouldn't have been trying to cut the cities and counties, that being the ones closest to the voters, in our communities, and with tasks to really uphold the infrastructure of the state, that by investing in the communities is investing in the state, and maintaining our infrastructure. As they reported, they've been cut dramatically already to maintain the communities. We want to keep our youth in the state. Who wants to be here with a crumbling infrastructure? Several communities are doing things like reducing hours and closing rec centers. So what are the kids to do? I've talked to one individual here in Cheyenne, a prominent member that is frustrated that Cheyenne can't get a rec center here. You know, that water, sewers, and just the vital supports for individuals, I think, and creating jobs. I just personally think that. It's money well spent, and we should always invest well in our communities.
Further comments?
Last word.
Please.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not trying to be punitive toward the cities and counties, but if we can go ahead and give them the full $105 million, and I'll vote for it if this amendment goes down anyway. But the fact of the matter is, in 4 years, we won't have $105 million to give them. We won't have $90 million to give them. We won't have anything to give them. We've got to we are trimming our budget, and we are trying to trim it. And I think they also have to get used to the idea of reduced of income coming from the state. We're not riding to their rescue. we can.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And being the bringer of that same motion you just made a year ago and 2 years ago, I understand where you're coming from. But I always got it stuffed back down my throat. So.
Which I am fully prepared to get.
Representative Lars.
I think, Mr. Chairman, the reality of the 105 is somewhat arbitrary. We've stuck with it for the last couple of years. I don't think there is a great deal of study or understanding on how that was resolved. But I think in order to wean cities and counties off state funds, then we need to give them, before we do that, then we need to give them ability to generate the revenue locally in a different fashion. So if we can pass that and allow them to do that, then I agree.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Coacher.
I'll just add the proviso that ever since we took the tax off food, I've been wanting to give the cities and counties the authority to put that tax back on a local basis. And I've been rejected soundly by both WAM and the county commissioners, both individually and collectively. I've been wanting to give them that authority all along. And that's been thrown back in my face the way I think this next vote's going to be.
With that, all those in favor of the motions, please say aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
That motion fails. Further motions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Summers.
So, Mr. Chairman, I just want to throw out this idea once again and get a little feedback from Don over there. So the idea of, you know, of a trial run perhaps on changing that split from between locals and the general fund for the sales and use tax distribution, is that something, one, that could be done in a budget bill that you could actually do that split? So the idea would be to change it from 31 to 35, and you would take that 4% and you would deposit it in a government distribution account, and then you would reduce the anticipated $105 million appropriation to locals by the same. And so is that something, one, we could do in the budget, and two, what would it look like? So as a matter of you would do a 4%, so 4% could end up being whatever it is, right? So you just say that in the end, how would that be operationalized? Because the 4% could be 51.8 million, it could be 45 million, it could be theoretically 60 million, because we don't really know the exact amount of revenue that's going to come in.
Mr. Chairman, several questions embedded in there, I believe. The first one is LSO has opined in the past that changes to revenue distribution can occur for the period of the budget within the budget bill. You've already voted on at least two of those provisions earlier this week on FMRs and severance taxes. With respect to how the mechanics of that would work, the dollars in your description would be deposited into a separate account, and then any appropriation in this year would be reduced by a like amount. It will take a fair bit of accounting. You're exactly right. In the first year, for example, the distribution is $52 million. That distribution would have to be paid for by LSRA or general fund or whatever other account you desire the appropriation to come from, and then it could be backfilled with sales and use tax collections for the period of the remainder of the fiscal year. If it came in at 40, the 51.8 is a biennial number, so let's cut that in half and talk about 25. If it came in at 20, it would generate, two-fifths of the payments to municipalities and counties for that year. If it came in at 30, it would cover three-fifths of the payments. There would be a fair bit of accounting. I would defer to Josh on one question, whether or not a distribution of a sales tax could occur in this bill. It, by prior LSO advice, it could occur in the budget bill. Could the distribution be modified in this bill? I don't know. I have not visited.
Mr. Chairman,
I think it would be appropriate in this bill. I think it could be a single subject and be appropriate for this bill. And it may make sense just because then you wouldn't have to cross-reference bills to the distribution under this bill. And so it would fit all under one, I think.
So another question, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Chairman, if I want to contemplate this a little longer, is this something that, you know, if this became a House bill, then we could amend that into the House bill, or because of the subject title, we would have to do so now to change the subject title. So do we have the ability to do this after I understand the ramifications a little more if we wanted to do it later in an amendment, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, I think as the bill's drafted, I think, you know, that's something that could at least arguably fit in a later amendment after it's introduced. You know, if you want to be safe, I think do it now. But at least arguably it's under the same topic. It is going another step out there, and so you might get some pushback on it.
So let's just move on to this bill because we're not going to do anything on it now. And if you want to, We can play with the rest of this concept both tomorrow and on this bill once we adopt it. So the any further amendments to this bill? Seeing none. Question being called. All those in favor as drafted. Don, is it a roll call?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The roll call is on 18 LSO 0213, formal draft 1.1.
So, Mr. Chairman, if we do a roll call, can we bring the bill back if we want to?
Sure.
Okay.
Go ahead, Don.
Mr. Chairman, only with the motion to reconsider, and there are additional requirements on this committee regarding – actually, I believe there's a 15-day requirement. I don't know whether this committee is exempt from that or not.
Mr. Chairman, then it's already been determined between us that it's going to be a Senate file. So anything you want to do, you may want to do sooner. You may want to ask if you're determined to do this, you may want to ask to lay the bill back.
Or we could
until this afternoon or something.
Have a conforming amendment to make sure that the caption is big enough to bring in.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to lay the bill back till this afternoon, and then we make have a little discussion on this. For one thing, if we change, Mr. Chairman, the other question I'd have to LSO, if we change this distribution, does it have to start in the House, and does it would it then? Because it's just a distribution and not a revenue, you're all right, right?
Yeah. Okay. You want to lay it back?
Mr. Chairman, I think I would.
Okay, we'll do so. Let's take a
Mr. Chairman, real quick before you go. I got the real numbers on the fire deal, okay. Not that we've already voted. $94,000 a year for Campbell and $50,000 for Sweetwater. I just got them sent to me.
Okay.
So. Okay, now it's been defeated. Can I make more arguments for it?
No. So we're going to lay this back. Let's take a quick short break. We're going to have lunch at 12 o'clock because we got a field trip scheduled. So if we'll come back and try to squeeze in the retirement contribution bill before lunch. So before we start, Representative Somers, I think you had a...
Yeah, so, Mr. Chairman, you know, I would be ready to move forward on this local government bill if it was the pleasure of the chair.
So, do you have a motion on it? We can reopen, yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I would have a motion, and that is to amend on page 1, line 3, strike the word formulas after funding. And then it makes the title a little more expansive. And then if down the road in either body, if we decide to amend what I was talking about into it, then we'd be able to do so. So that would be my amendment.
Second. Moved and seconded, and all those in favor to amend line 3 as strike the word formula, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
That motion carries.
What was the vote?
It was
2-1. Mr. Chairman, before that, I've got a question. If you remove the word, if I may, if you remove the word formulas, we'd have no way of distributing this money, would be the way I read that. And so then it would just be a free-for-all out there, and it would be an entertaining WWE fight possibly, but I don't know that it would be functional for the state.
I don't think that's correct because the formula is outlined in the bill.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'd agree the formula is outlined in the bill.
And
it doesn't limit the discussion.
And Representative Summers got this instruction from LSO, so I think they've considered it. But if you want to ask that question to LSO, if that's a concern. Don, any comments on it? Tamara?
Mr. Chairman, the other discussion, Mr. Anderson has left. But if there are members who feel the proposal does not meet your intent, another opportunity that was discussed was rather than striking the word formulas, adding the word distributions and distributions.
Mr. Chairman, I would be comfortable with whichever the committee felt appropriate. So if there was another amendment that wanted to come and change that to and distribution.
Mr. Chairman, I would demand agreeable with the originator of the motion that we add the word distribution.
So there's been a request, a friendly amendment to amend your motion.
So yeah. If I may, so then that puts formula back in and adds distribution?
Formula
and distribution.
And distribution. So a friendly amendment?
Friendly amendment.
So with the friendly amendment, all those in favor of the friendly amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That motion carries. As amended, does that satisfy your concerns, Representative Walters?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, as amended, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? That motion carries.
Do you need another new roll call vote?
So as amended, roll call vote.
Mr. Chairman, the roll call vote is on 18 LSO 0213, formal draft 1.1, as amended. Representative Burkhart.
Aye.
Representative Larson.
Aye.
Representative Schwartz.
Aye.
Representative Summers.
Aye.
Representative Walters.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Senator Dockstetter.
Aye.
Senator Driscoll.
Aye.
Senator Hastert.
Aye.
Senator Landon.
Aye.
Co-Chairman Burns.
Aye.
Chairman Nicholas.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman, the motion has been adopted. How, Senate file?
I think it's a Senate file.
We'll fix it.
Okay, with that, let's move to House Bill 0418, draft, working draft 0.5. This is 418, public employees retirement plan contributions. I think that's where we're at. Very quickly, I think we've walked through this once before, but Tamara, just kind of give us a synopsis of this bill again.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tamara Revley. This bill draft is an amended version of a bill draft you considered last week. That bill draft you considered last week was similarly 18 LSO 0418. It was an earlier version of the working draft, and it was named Wyoming Retirement Plans-Contributions-3. The amendments were made during the meeting. Some were conceptual. They were to change the plans that were affected by a retirement rate increase and to change the amount of the increase and the period over which it's increased. So now, turning to the bill that's in front of you, you now see it's titled with the catch title, Public Employee Retirement Plan-Contributions, and that's because the committee desired that this bill only affect the public employee's retirement plan. Similarly, the actual title is amended as well. Just conceptually, who's affected by this bill are public employees, Tier 1 and Tier 2. What is increased is both the employee and the employer contribution rate. The amount is 1% each for a total of 2%. This affects the employee contribution rate that is paid out of pocket, actually paid by the employee and not picked up by the state or other entity. And the timing of the increase is that it would begin September 1st, 2018, and increase each year in 1/4 percentages. So I can briefly point out the provisions of the bill that were changed and how they were changed.
Mr. Co-Chair.
When did you say it starts?
September 1st, 2018.
Why September 1st?
That, Mr. Chairman, that was a choice that was made in prior years as to when to begin contribution rate increases. And I believe the thinking is that some teacher contracts run through the summer, and this was a method to begin those rate increases after those contracts.
But, Mr. Chairman, if it started July 1st, when the teachers' contracts came in, it would already be in effect. And you know, it may be nitpicky, but the stuff you do, the earlier you do it, the larger effect it has. So I'm wondering why we wouldn't want July 1st.
Mr. Chairman, I think Don Richards might be able to comment on this. He had a little bit more idea of the rationale for this than I did in practice. I think it affects teachers that are – their contract was already set the prior year, and it runs through this next summer.
Oh, I see. All
so right. Existing contracts.
All right.
Yeah, I believe we've gone through that concept before, and which is why it made more sense to start it September 1st for various reasons. But Don can readdress them. So okay. Go ahead.
I'll move on to the bill draft itself. Page 1, you see the title. It now relates only to public employees. It increases employee and employer contribution rates in that plan. It requires the increased contribution rates to be paid through a reduction in the cash salary as specified. It gets rid of some archaic provisions, and it provides appropriations. Moving on to page 2, this is the public employee plan. This is the employee contribution rate increase. This stricken language removes the old contribution rate and implements a new stepped increase beginning July 1st would be 1/4% increase. The next would come, I'm sorry, beginning September 1st, 2018. The next comes in July 1st, 2019. The next July 1st, 2020. And then finally beginning July 1st, 2021 and thereafter, we get to an employee contribution rate of 9.25%. Moving on to page 3. Subsection C governs the portion of the employee contribution rates that's paid out of pocket by the employee and the portion that's paid or picked up by the employer. Again, we're still talking about employee contribution rates and just the picked up portion. For state employees, you see there on page 3, line 15 and 16, the portion that's paid by the employer, picked up by the employer, is 5.57%. So when we increase the employee contribution rate and leave this alone, that by effect means employees have to pay that remaining portion out of pocket, whatever's increased. You see that some old language is stricken here. Moving on to page 4.
Chairman, could you repeat that last piece with the 5.57%? Because I missed it. I didn't understand it.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Summers. If you, on page 3, if you begin on page 4, you see that the employer may pay these employee contribution rates by a reduction in the cash salary of the member or by an offset against future salary increase or by a combination of a reduction in salary and an offset against a future salary increase, provided that for state employee members, 5.57% of the member salary shall be paid by the employer without any salary reduction or offset. So 5.57% is the set amount the state is paying, picking up of the employee contribution rate increase. We're leaving that the same. So if we increase the total rate by 1%, that leaves the employee to pay that out of pocket. If we increase it by 2%, that leaves the state employee to pay it out of pocket.
Please.
So essentially then what that's saying is that all of the increase that we're contemplating in this bill is borne by the employees.
That's right, Mr. Chairman, Senator Landon. Members of the committee, moving on to page 4.
Mr. Chairman, just to clarify that, all of the increase in the employee's part will be borne by the employee. The similar increase in the employer part will, of course, be borne by the employer.
That makes more sense. Representative Schwartz.
Thank you.
That's correct.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just for further clarification, in instances, and it wouldn't be the state probably, where the employer chooses to pick up some of the employee's increase, that's still allowed, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schwartz, I'll get to that next provision. That hasn't changed since you saw the bill last.
That's on page 5.
Yes, that's moving on to page 5. I'll finish up here just on page 4. Paragraph 4 just applies the same thing to brand inspector contract employees as was provided for state employees in the prior paragraph. Moving on to paragraph 5, this is for the intent of this bill, as it was requested to me, was to have this contribution rate affect employees. I think myself and another drafter that worked on the bill determined that it might not work to do that across the board for every single member in the public employees plan. So this paragraph 5 brings in several employers that are at least some state funding is provided directly or indirectly to these government entities. And for the most part, they have taxing authority. So it leaves out a lot of the quasi-government entities, such as the Wyoming School Activities Association, et cetera, that are explained there in that staff comment for you. So again, paragraph 5 brings in these employers that are receive state funding indirectly or directly, and says for those entities that are participating, their employees also must pay the same increase, or at least an amount equivalent to a stepped-in quarter increase each year. So moving on to page 5, implements that stepped increase paid actually out of pocket by those entities, and the staff comment details all of those entities. So if there's not any other questions on that increase, I'll move on to the employer increase portions.
Please.
So as I was looking at that, I had in my mind, Tamara, previously that we was looking at 2%, or is it 1% in 4 years, 1% total? And what's the total time frame that this takes place over?
Mr. Chairman, the total time frame is 4 years. The total increase is 2%.
Quarter a year.
Quarter a year by employee and employer.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So moving on to the top of page 5 and on to page 6 is the employer increase. And we're only affecting the public employee plan, so you see that air fire guard plan and law enforcement is not included in this increase, which was the same as for employees. On page 6, lines 13 through 21, you see the same stepped-in timing increase for the employer. Finally, moving on to page 7, begins the appropriation to fund this employer increase. We've already talked about how the employee contribution rate is paid for. Now we move on to the appropriation for the employer amount. For legislative employees on page 8, a $20,000 appropriation is made for this upcoming biennium only, of course. For judicial employees, $36,000. For executive branch employees, $1,417,000. For community college, contribution rates, $390,000. For the University of Wyoming, $592,000. For school district employees in subsection B, $6,238,000. On to page 9, subsection C provides for a like appropriation for employees who are funded from non-general fund sources. Subsection D puts some limits on the appropriation and just states that they'll only be used for these employer contribution rates that are provided for in this bill. Subsection T similarly limits the school foundation program appropriation for what's appropriated for in this bill. Subsection F states that no part of these appropriations shall be used to provide for an increased employee contribution. Again, we're limiting it to employer, and this is the similar way that appropriations were done in prior years. Subsection G just provides for the reversion. Subsection H gives the auditor some direction. And subsection J defines state agency for purposes of this appropriation. So that's the bill. I can let public comment if we're ready or answer questions.
Questions from the committee on the bill. Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. In my mind are contracts out across the state. If a contract is in place, nothing is changing in that contract. And I'm going to ask you if I'm thinking correctly, Tamara, okay? The contract doesn't change, but now what has changed is the state is saying we need to contribute more into the retirement fund. And we are asking employers and employees to share in that additional amount. Is that a way for us to look at this or to explain it? Or not?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Landon, yes, I believe that's a way for you to explain it. This is how contribution rates have been increased historically. We haven't included any kind of an applicability provision contemplating what happens to contracts that are out there.
Further questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just so that I'm clear, this bill we're doing because we're changing the contribution rate and thus appropriating for this purpose. But in the next budget year or when we do, 2 years from now, this appropriate amount would be rolled into the Series 100 governor's recommendations all, wouldn't it be?
Mr. Chairman. I think you're treating this as a budget bill, and it's not. This is regular. This is a regular bill, so this becomes statute. So whatever we're doing here is permanent until we undo it or redo it.
But so then this like amount will increase the budget bill 2 years from now. I mean it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don will be going over that with us. Not too far, in the not too far distant future. Further comments?
Move the bill.
Second.
Bill has been moved and seconded. It as amended. All those in favor of the bill? I think have we already approved the bill, or we haven't?
No, Mr. Chairman, you have not. If there are no,
amendments.
Amendments. Are you ready
roll call? Yeah. Sure. Well, we can take public comments first. We've got 8 minutes for public comment.
I'm sorry, but don't we need to just first make a motion on the bill to
no.
Add public comment?
No, Mr. Chairman.
I think we've already done that.
No, we
did that in concept.
Yeah.
We moved the bill after public comment.
Yep.
Because after public input has been put in, then we moved the bill and work.
So public comment.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tammy Schroeder with Wyoming Education Association. I'd like to have you look at page number four, line 20, then on over to page 5 at the bottom of line 6. And we stand to support this bill with the exception that we'd like you to delete that portion, partially because if you do that, this will allow the retirement system to grow even more. If the employer is contributing a portion of the employee's contribution and then that employee leaves, in the bill that you're going to consider next under that bill, more of that money would stay in the retirement system. So I think that would be a benefit to the retirement system in that way, as well as allowing the local boards, the local elected boards, to contract with their employees the way they have historically. So without removing that freedom to contract that, that you've given the local boards through statute, they would be able to continue to do that. So I'll just be that brief, and if you have questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Representative Simons.
Mr. Chairman, it just seemed to me, and maybe you can speak to this, as we're challenged with how to fund education, one thing we can do, little thing we can do here is ensure that the employees pay their fair share and that districts don't put this burden back on the school foundation account. So can you speak to that, the fact that we kind of have to look at our dollars?
Chairman Nicholas, Representative Summers, yes, I can. When the money comes to the school districts in a block grant, it's all in one big pile, and as you know, they spend it how they see fit and they see best for their district under the guise of their local elected board. In this case, it doesn't cost the foundation any more money to have the employer pay the employee's portion. It's often part of the negotiated compensation package. So, you know, districts do, particularly in lean times, districts will do what's best for them and what works best. So they may not pay as high a salary, which, as you know, would be a bigger payout at the end of the employee's term within the retirement system. But they may pay a lower salary and pay a portion of the employee's retirement benefit so that it fits with their accounting practices better and what they need to do for their district. I think there's three districts in the state maybe now that pay 100% of their employees' contribution, and they do that in lieu of a higher salary. That's the way they negotiate it. So that ability to contract with their employees what works best for the district and what works best for the employees is what we're looking at here.
Representative Larson.
Your example is well and good, and I appreciate that. If there was a restriction that limited the districts when times weren't lean, that when the salaries being paid to school district employees are above all the surrounding states and we're still paying their portion. Now, if you want to restrict it in that, and we could put some sideboards on that says that when the salaries drop, that then they consider that, but I'm concerned that we have school districts around that have been paying the employees portion of the share even when times weren't difficult. And it was being used as a tool, a recruitment tool. But I would suggest that by virtue of I think it's an ability to abuse the funding model for the district as well, even though we do give them the local control on how to do that. I think sometimes that that imposes a challenge to resources.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Doxter.
I echo that concern that it opens up an opportunity to abuse. Don't you feel that the employees are willing in these difficult times to pay more of their fair share?
Chairman Nicholas, Senator Dockstetter, employees are, like I said, we're in support of this bill, and we believe that the employees should pay their fair share. And whether that comes through a salary reduction where the employer pays more and then more stays in the retirement system for those people who leave after 2 or 3 years of service, or it goes into straight out of a lower salary and a higher contribution, or a higher salary and a lower contribution. I don't think the money at the end of the day is any different. But the money into the retirement system has the potential to be greater, and then the districts have the flexibility to meet their own specific financial needs. So, yeah.
Mr. Chairman,
please.
Thank you. I understand from what you're saying, and what I'm getting out of what you're saying is that you're in support of the bill, you're in support of the concept that employees pay a fair share, But are you saying that that you'd feel better if it was left to the local entities?
Chairman Nicholas and Senator Hassert, yes, that's what I'm saying. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Further public comment? Seeing none, public comment is closed. I think we're ready for a roll call on the bill.
Now we'll move the bill.
Move the bill. Moved and second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. No.
Nope. Now we're ready for roll call.
Okay. Unless there's any amendments.
Fire away, Don.
Mr. Chairman, the vote is on 18 LSO 0418, working draft 0.5. Representative Burkhart.
Aye.
Representative Larson.
Aye.
Representative Schwartz. Representative Summers.
Aye.
Representative Walters.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
Aye.
Senator Dockstetter.
Aye.
Senator Driscoll.
Aye.
Senator Hastert.
Aye.
Senator Landon.
Aye.
Co-Chairman Burns.
Just go grab him. Just grab
Chairman
him.
Nicholas.
Aye. You got
his. Mr. Chairman, the motion is agreed to. Will this be a Senate file or House bill?
It's a House bill. Thanks. Okay. With that, we've got lunch, and there's a bus going to be picking us in about 15 minutes. So we're going to be in recess until we return. My guess is it'll be 1:30. All things, all lucky. I've got his. I need those signed, the House ones.
Okay.